You've painted up your lips and rolled and curled your tinted hair. Ruby, are you contemplating going out somewhere? The shadow on the wall tells me the sun is going down. Take your love to town. It wasn't me that started that old crazy Asian war, but I was proud to go and do my patriotic chore. And yes, it's true that I'm not the man I used to be. Some company. It's hard to love a man whose legs are bent and paralyzed, and the wants and the needs of a woman your age, Ruby, I realize. But it won't be long, I've heard them say, until I'm not around. Your love to town. She's leaving now, 'cause I just heard the slamming of the door. The way I know I've heard it slam 100 times before. And if I could move, I'd get my gun and put her in the ground. Take your love to town. For God's sakes, turn around.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear us at accesssacramento.org, or you can review past programs at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com, or you can friend us on Facebook. Today's program is about the Iraq War and Thomas E. Ricks. After 21 years of conflict with Iraq, is there something we can learn? To break it down, the Gulf War started on August 2nd, 1990 and ended in 1991. Then, the Iraq no-fly zone started in 1991 and ended in 2003. And the current war in Iraq started in 2003. In this interview about the Iraq War with Thomas E. Ricks, he's interviewed by Harry Chrysler. Thomas E. Ricks has led an interesting life. Reviewing the conduct of the Iraq War, he analyzes the weaknesses and strengths of America's political and military leaders, the long-term consequences of the conflict, and the future of Iraq and the possibilities of a new American strategy for the Mideast under President Obama.
You talked about the fall of Saigon, the fall of Kabul, and so as a person who both loved, respected, and analyzed and could be critical about the military, what were your feelings as the Iraq War unfolded, especially in its first phase? Because it seemed to be a breakdown of almost all of our institutions.
I had a feeling of deep unease. Actually, 2003, 04, and 05 were actually a very difficult time for me personally. It was just an enormous strain and sort of looking at this. I had actually thought that invading Afghanistan after 9/11 was exactly the right thing to do. Al-Qaeda came out of there. Sure, they were all Saudi Arabians, but they were almost all. But they were based in Afghanistan. From the beginning, Iraq just puzzled me. Why are we doing this? And when I would go to people I knew at the Pentagon, senior officers, names people know. And I'd ask, well, I don't understand what's going on here. And they'd say, neither do we. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about this in Fiasco, actually. So many officers on the combatant commands around the world, the senior sort of U.S. military headquarters, had queried the joint staff, why are we doing this drive to Iraq? That a really unusual order was issued. You will consider any invasion of Iraq to be part of the global war on terror. Well, okay, the military got the message, and that's right for them to get the message. In our system, you do want a civilian oversight of the military, a military consciously subordinate of civilian control. And so when the civilians say, you know, this is part of the war on terror, they said, okay, it's part of the war on terror. But the screw-up in Iraq was far deeper than that. I remember being in Baghdad in the spring of 2003, in the immediate aftermath of the invasion. This is May. And being struck by the enormous discrepancy between what the Americans said and thought and what the Iraqis did. By luck, one of my colleagues was Anthony Shadid at the Washington Post. He's now at the New York Times. Terrific reporter, really nice guy. I was embedded with the 1st Armored Division, then commanded by Major General Ricardo Sanchez, who went on to become the American commander in the first year. He was essentially embedded in Solder City with a solderist. Every couple of days, Anthony and I would meet at the Washington Post Bureau, have a few beers, sit out back and talk. And I got the sense in those weeks, this is the only place in Baghdad where these two very different views are being brought together and compared. I think my all-time favorite story was on Memorial Day of 2003. Anthony and I went out with the 1st Armored Division and the 1st Armored Division Patrol. Though the name is Armored, it was an infantry patrol in West Baghdad. And we had talked to the lieutenant and his commanders before this. I embedded in the patrol and walked with them and talked with them. We were in a section of Baghdad called Yarmouk in West Baghdad, a very Ba'athist Sunni and actually very much military retirees section of Baghdad. Anthony walked along behind the patrol talking to the Iraqis. And it was painfully evident at the end of the patrol, Anthony and I sat down, and the American soldiers were saying, they love us, see the kids. They stopped off. They visited an orphanage. They were very careful to take off their sunglasses before going in. They put their weapons outside, left them under guard with another soldier. And their point was, the kids love us. We visited the orphanage. We're protecting people. And Anthony said, well, when I talked to the Iraqi men outside the orphanage, they said you went inside to have sex with the teachers. Hmm. And one of the young soldiers said, but what about the kids? He said, well, you're seeing some of the kids. I went over and talked to a 15-year-old who said, when they walk by, they walk in my heart. This was just stunning, shocking to the Americans. And we sat down and wrote that story. An odd thing about being a military correspondent is the better your material, the easier it is to write. Combat is the easiest thing in the world to cover. You just sit and write it down, and it goes bam. I was once in an ambush, and the story took 20 minutes to write, right on the front page of the Post the next day. Anthony and I sat down and wrote that story, and it just sailed onto the front page of the next day's Post. And to me, that really captured the essence of the problem, just fundamental misunderstandings about what we thought we were doing there and how the Iraqis perceived it.
This raises the interesting question about the whole problem of embedding and how one navigates, you know, on the one hand, really reporting and analyzing what's going on, and doing that in a context where you're not becoming servant of the Pentagon propaganda machine. But on the other hand, as you just pointed out, if you're doing your job well and you're getting sources of information from different places, you can really reveal both the good on our side and, and the bad.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of embedding. I've always thought, first of all, it's a great way to educate a reporter. And one of the problems we have nowadays with reporters is not a lot of them have military experience or understanding. Being embedded, first of all, just teaches you a lot. I would never have an idle moment in embed. I mean, if I'm just sitting there and it's boring, I would turn to a soldier and say, you're the 50 cal gunner. Explain the 50 cal to me. When you look at this piece of machinery, what do you think? I've done this with pilots. Walk me around your aircraft. When you look at this, what does this mean to you? How does this work? What do you like about it? What do you dislike about it? So it's endlessly educating. The second thing is the military view is a legitimate view. You want to present it. In fact, to my readers, it was the most important thing. These were their wives, husbands, sons, brothers, sisters in the field. And that's a crucial story for the American reader to understand. My third thought in being an embed was I'm writing for several audiences, the Washington Post. I'm writing for a huge military establishment around Washington. And every story I write, there's somebody who actually knows the subject better than me. So a little bit of humility helps. I'm also writing for members of Congress and the 20,000 people who work for them and the 100,000 people who lobby them, who have a lot of influence over the military but generally know nothing about it. Third, I'm writing for people who know nothing about any of this, and I need to make them understand it and care about it also. So these several different audiences really struck me. In Iraq, there was another audience that began to worry me. One day I was talking to an intelligence officer, and he said, "Tom, I just thought you should know, we were going to an Iraqi military headquarters, and one of your stories was printed out and pinned up on the wall." Mm. Interesting, okay. So people who are the enemy are now reading me in real time. What does that mean? How do you take that into account? So embedding to me was, you'll get, it's like the blind man and the elephant. You'll feel the leg of the elephant. Is it the whole elephant? No, but it's an important part of that elephant, and one that my readers really cared about.
Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Dialing $4 is trying to find me. I wait for delivery each day until 3. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a color TV? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? I'm counting on you, Lord. Please don't let me down. Prove that you love me and buy the next round. Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a night on the town? Everybody, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? My friends all drive Porsches. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime. No help from my friends. So, oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes Benz? That's it.
Now, in addition to as you were embedded and walking the streets of Baghdad as you just described, what were your other sources of information about what was going on? Because you had a situation where our military was now wired. How did that impact on the conversation you could have with different levels of the military, mm-hmm. to sort of ultimately reveal the absolute terrible situation that we placed our soldiers in? In Fiasco, you had you clearly were reading a lot of the battlefield reports, and there was one report that you quote by a soldier or an officer saying that what we were doing there was pasting feathers hoping for a duck, an amazing quote.
I had a fairly conscious, intellectualized approach to reporting, which is there is always a level of action. There's a level at which there's a guy who knows what the theory is, but also knows what the practice is. In different wars, it's different levels. If I'm covering World War I, it's probably the division or even the corps level. World War II, almost certainly the division or the regimental combat team level. In small wars, frequently, it's the platoon or company commander level. I found in Iraq it was the battalion level. Hmm. These guys knew what the theory was. Sometimes the division commander was just clueless, never got out of his headquarters. Frequently, the top commanders, a Petraeus, would be very well informed. Then you had a couple of levels of profound ignorance, and then some really informed levels. What I found in Iraq was that was the battalion commander level. So I spent a lot of time with battalion commanders. What I typically would do was come in country and say to the military, give me all the briefings you want. Hit me with your best shot. So you get all the theory. And then I would descend every echelon down from corps, division, brigade, battalion, company, platoon, squad, fire team. And when I got down to the bottom, I'd say, okay, now I'm going to go back up to the level where reality meets theory. And that would, again, take me back up to battalion. Then at the end, I usually would go back to the very top people and say, this is what you told me. This is what I saw. This is the discrepancy I perceive. How would you explain that? And kind of an iterative process, really almost Hegelian synthesis coming out of it. Then, when I wrote Fiasco, I took all my reporting and I sat down to write and discovered something that I hadn't expected, hadn't really come home to me yet, which was all the people I had talked to in Iraq. And by that point, I think I had talked to, well, my colleague, Vern Loeb, had talked to almost every single battalion commander there that year and knew them and were in contact with them. As I finished each section of the book, I would email it to everybody who was mentioned because I had all their email addresses. And you can figure out what their email addresses are if they're in the military pretty easily. And so I would email and say, here's what I'm writing. Speak now or forever hold your peace. And guys would write back to me, sorry, Tom, look, I was in a firefight all yesterday. I'm really whipped, but give me till tomorrow and I'll write to you. The next day, a thoughtful note would come, frequently with attachments. And here's the significant incident report I filed. And then I got into some nastier stuff, and people would say, well, look, here's the affidavit I filed. So I go through the affidavit and put that in the book, and I'd send it to everybody who was in the affidavit. Guys would write back, look, I don't know how you found out who I am, but clearly you've been talking to my battalion commander. Let me tell you, you know, here's my take on it. Here's the statement I gave to investigators. I wound up going through about 32,000 pages of documents, compiling them and sending people again and again, here's the chapter as it stands now. Most interestingly, this was General Odierno, who was criticized very heavily in Fiasco, but actually praised quite well in Gamble. Interesting difference. He initially declined to talk to me. I said, fine, you know, that's your privilege. Then I sent him the chapter about his division, and he came hustling over to my office with a pile of documents. I said, here, let me, you know, and we sat and talked for most of a day with his side of the story. Interestingly, when I did the Gamble, he was very open with me, despite my having been very critical of him in Fiasco. And I think it's because he thought he disagreed with it, but he'd gotten a fair shot. He'd had his chance to tell his side of the story, give his response.
Mm-hmm. Let me very briefly show the two books. Fiasco is the story of the first phase of the war, and your second book, The Gamble, is the story of the turnaround under General Petraeus. And in Fiasco, you really do more than what was going on in Iraq. It's really an analysis of the strategic debate in Washington, the failure of the press, the failure of the Congress. Talk a little about that, and because it seems absolutely essential to understand the failure in Washington to understand the failure in Iraq, because we didn't have the resources on the battlefield we needed, and we were very unclear what we were doing there, and this was not something that the military should be providing. It really should be the civilian leadership.
You write a book for one reason, at least I do, is because you have to, and Fiasco was very much figuring out how did we have this massive failure. Since I wrote Fiasco, I've actually come to, I think, get to an even sort of broader understanding. I think actually what happened was after 9/11, we had a national panic. The role of our leaders should be to tamp down panic. And I think the Bush administration, President Bush, Vice President Cheney, instead fed that panic. I think they panicked personally, partly because even the White House was perceived to have been under attack. Donald Rumsfeld was in the Pentagon when it was hit by the airliner. So I think this was very personal for them, and I do think they were knocked off balance. And I think the whole country was knocked off balance. And remember, we invaded Iraq just 2 years after 9/11. And I think it took us several years to regain our equilibrium. And when the country was off balance, people were not thinking clearly. It wasn't just the press. It was a massive failure of Congress to deal with this. There was an air of confusion about the entire enterprise. I was constantly struck in Iraq that the civilians and the military, the U.S. civilians like Bremer and the military, were at odds in their understanding of the mission. Bremer was trying to carry out revolutionary operations. Let's transform Iraq into a beacon of democracy. The military, on its own, redefined the mission of stability. Well, those two missions are at odds. And they never resolved that. And so we had these sort of people just butting heads together, and the Iraqis wondering, what are these people trying to do here?
Mm-hmm. And going back to your earlier experiences after the end of the Cold War, it seems that this was these questions were never resolved in our own mind. I mean, do we intervene in places like Kosovo or Somalia for humanitarian concerns, or are we doing it for our security interests? And it seems that as the Bush administration was trying to figure out what it had gotten itself into, that they were constantly changing in their own mind what they wanted to accomplish there.
Well, actually, I would disagree with that a bit. I think the Bush administration was very clear on what it thought it was doing. It was responding to 9/11, and I remember Paul Wolfowitz was in many ways the intellectual architect of this. We're going to drain the swamp of terror. And their whole attitude, anytime anybody brought up an objection, that's old thing. That's pre-9/11 thinking. Wolfowitz liked to say, well, that's exactly the type of thing that led to 9/11. All those State Department Arabists talking about the Arab street, saying, you know, you can't do that. No, this, everything was new. It was almost a Trotskyite sort of, this is, you know, year zero. History has nothing to tell us here. And so they were very clear about what they thought they were doing. In retrospect, it was an insane mission. The world's youngest culture is going to go in and change the world's oldest culture at the point of a gun. And we're going to get out quickly. Remember, the original plan was to be down to 30,000 troops in Iraq by September 2003. This was going to be a six-month mission.
Questions,
what's that?
For their mothers as they ran. But no one stopped to think about the babies or how they would survive. And we've almost lost Detroit this time. Ever get over losing our minds? Just 30 miles from Detroit stands a giant power station. It ticks each night as the city sleeps. Seconds from annihilation. But no one stopped to think about the people or how they would survive. And we've almost lost Detroit this time. How would we ever get over? Monroe County had a sure enough disasters on his mind. And what would Karen Silkwood say to you if she was still alive? That when it comes to people's safety, money wins out every time. And we've almost lost Detroit this time.
Detroit. That time I almost lost Detroit. That time. And how will we ever get over the odds are we're gonna lose somewhere. One time. Odds are we're gonna lose somewhere. Sometime. And how will we ever get over losing our mind? How will we ever get over losing our mind? Didn't they decide? Almost lost Detroit. That time, damn near totally destroyed. One time.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.